Amory and WBZH 910 AM W245 CT Hayward.
Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. They've rescued American explorer Mark Dickey after spending a week thousands of feet down in a cave in Turkey. He'd been suffering a gastrointestinal illness. It brought Dickey out on a stretcher, smiling. His family says he's in stable condition. Crews still searching through earthquake rubble in Morocco's Atlas Mountains where the quake was centered. Entire neighborhoods destroyed. This man lives in a mountain village.
It was like a very bad dream I like to wake up from, but I cannot find any, you know, like situation to wake up.
More than 2,800 people killed in those Morocco earthquakes so far. On his way back from Asia, President Biden stopping in Anchorage, Alaska, marking the anniversary of 9/11.
We must not succumb to the poisonous politics of difference and division. We must never allow ourselves to be pulled apart by petty, manufactured grievances.
This is ABC News. It was a big step toward a prisoner swap deal with Iran. It also involves a lot of money.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken has signed off on a sanctions waiver allowing international banks to transfer roughly $6 billion in frozen oil revenue to Iran in exchange for the release of five detained American citizens, a move members of Congress were informed of today, according to several sources. This development advances a deal in principle struck between the U.S. and Iran last month. One official advises that the detainees could be headed home as soon as next week. Shannon Crawford, ABC News.
Sheriffs across New Mexico say they will not enforce a temporary ban enacted by Governor Michelle Grisham on open and concealed carry laws. Bernalillo County Sheriff John Allen disagrees.
I'm all about gun violence and making sure that my friend's daughter who called me last night is not asking me to provide her with a bulletproof backpack and a taser because she's scared of a lockdown. I have to look and not just rule by emotions, but make sure it's common sense and that everybody's protected.
Andy Field, ABC News.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. Some Wisconsin Republican lawmakers are hesitating to vote on impeaching newly elected Supreme Court Justice Janet Protasiewicz. Representative Scott Johnson said in a statement, quote, "Elections have consequences. I will be honest in saying that I would encourage the justice to recuse herself from this case. However, I will not vote in favor of impeachment." Other Republican lawmakers have called to impeach Justice Protasiewicz over campaign statements regarding Wisconsin's electoral districts. A petition from Legal Action of Wisconsin seeks to decrease the amount of time eviction records are kept amid the impeachment threats surrounding the new liberal majority Supreme Court. The group seeks to change the rules so eviction records would be kept for only 1 year in cases where there was no monetary judgment against a tenant and be scrubbed from the Wisconsin Circuit Court website. Currently, eviction records must be maintained for 20 years after the close of a case. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
Delicious Honeycrisp, Granny Smith. If you have a favorite apple, now is the time to pick it straight from the source. Did you know Wisconsin has more than 300 apple orchards? Travel Wisconsin recently naming its favorites, including the Oneida National Apple Orchard outside Green Bay, Ferguson's Orchards in Eau Claire, and Apple Holler south of Racine. Many provide tons of family fun in the fall, too. Tire swings, lawn bowling, hay rides, and more. Apple experts suggest if you want to pick yours fresh, do it before the end of October. For Civic Media, I'm Terry.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
All of these things consistently come down to this: willingness of people to give up their agency and the willingness of Donald Trump and those who support him to leverage and abuse people's trust in them to further their own personal power and enrichment.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weeknights at 6 p.m. on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
New review of the safety of transporting volatile substances that must be kept at extremely low temperatures when shipped.
That is good news.
And finally, the Biden administration this week moved to impose a permanent ban on oil drilling across millions of acres of pristine Alaskan wilderness. The conservation action does not affect the controversial Willow Project due to a court judgment. In a separate announcement, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland moved to cancel all Trump-era drilling leases that had been permitted in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and restored the refuge's decades-long drilling ban.
Protections to be restored to Anwar.
Yep.
Excellent news. We'll take it. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. I'm going to start off with, obviously, it is 9/11. And 22 years ago today, to me, seems like it was yesterday, to be honest. Everyone I've talked to today, same kind of feeling. Knew where we were, what we were doing, who we were doing it with, what we were talking about. It seems burnt into our memories, into our minds, into who we are. And I'll tell you, I remember, you know, every detail of the day. I was back home in Cleveland. My grandmother was having a knee replacement done. We were at the Cleveland Clinic. I woke up unnaturally early that day. And it was like everyone says, it was a bright, beautiful, amazing day. The kind of day that you don't forget often. But not the kind of day you associate with the most tragic event of a lifetime. And, you know, I remember, you know, clearly we were around our family, everyone was there. And I remember at the moment that the news came on the TV, you know, what we were talking about, because we were busting each other's shoes as families do. And I remember the moment it happened, you could see the faces, the sorrow, the dismay, the confusion. And as the day went on, as the day unfolded, the anger and the division that then became. And that's one of those things that has stuck with me, because I was in a place, the Cleveland Clinic is a very diverse environment. Virtually people, it's like the United Nations, if you will, because it's an extraordinarily large teaching hospital. And in those hours that I was in that place, because we were there morning to night, you could see already us tearing apart. And, you know, I couldn't help that day while my grandmother was in surgery, because it was while it was going on, she was under the knife. Remembering, thinking this was someone who Pearl Harbor changed her life. That was their generation. And for her to go to sleep and wake up with another Pearl Harbor type attack in her lifetime, what that meant. And then, you know, we talked pretty much the whole time she was out about that, because a lot of my family members had military backgrounds, and immediately the older ones, her brother and her brother was like, you know, this is an attack. This is, you know, and he focused right in on that. And we talked about, what is this going to mean? You know, who is it? And everyone, you know, went to where eventually we figured out it was. And watching the behavior of people is something I'm never going to forget. And in those hours that my grandmother was under the knife, we talked about what the changes to the country were going to be. And it seems so eerie to me now. And I think about this every year on this day, how right we were, that this was going to ultimately was going to bring us together immediately. But long-term, this was going to rip us apart, because you could already see the divisions. We weren't the homogeneous country that the World War II generation was. We were a much more diverse country even then, because you could see the reactions of the people in the hospital. I remember two people of kind of Middle Eastern descent, you know, talking to each other and going, "Did you do that?" And it was not funny. And I remember thinking, how are we going to get past this? I remember driving home afterwards and gas prices going up to like $9 a gallon. Obviously, the city of Cleveland came back the next day and said, you go undo all of that damage you did. But that night, that's what it was. And that gave way to color-coded fear, if you remember. Remember the Tom Ridge, the color codes, the red for severe, the orange for high, and we were orange a lot, the yellow for elevated, the blue for guarded, and if it was green, it was low. Was rarely green, as I remember. Always throwing us in the yellow and the orange to keep people on edge. And that gave way to coded language then. You know, radical, Islamic, extremist, terrorist, all those words meant to incite, to anger, to pit us against, because war. Now look, I go back and I say I was all in favor of going into Afghanistan after bin Laden. 100%. You had me at, we're going to go get the people who did this. I get revenge. I get retribution. I get that 100%. And was all in favor. And I take responsibility for being all in favor of going, yeah, go get him. Whatever we need to do, whatever we have at our disposal, you go get those criminals, you go get those people, and you hold them accountable. However, I'm not a death penalty person, but you know what? If that's what happens, that's what happens. Then we made this bizarre turn. Got to go to Iraq. I was 100% against that. Again, tearing at the country, tearing us apart. And ever since then, it's been slicing and dicing. You know, I put out on Facebook today, I go, you know, everyone remembers where they were today. Everyone remembers what they were doing and who they were talking to, everyone who was alive. But do you remember yesterday? Do you remember what the country was like on the 10th? Do you remember not being divided as much? Do you remember not being as fearful? Do you remember being not as hateful? Because they used that masterfully to pit us against one another and everyone else. And globally, that response. Because, look, I wasn't alone in go after get bin Laden after 9/11. I was not alone in this. The country was basically unified. Go get them. But we made that turn. And we destabilized that whole region of the world. And we've destabilized the world because of it. I'm curious where folks were, what they were doing, what their thoughts on this day are. It's one of those things that, you know, it's hard to explain. But my fear at the time, and I talked about this quite extensively at that point. We're going to send people into harm's way. Because I remember watching those men come back from Vietnam. And we're not going to take care of them. And you look what we did to the 9/11 responders. How long it took to get them the funding that they needed. How long it took to get the VA budget and money. And we still don't have all of it. The rich got richer. The poor got poorer. And I remember at the time, you know, when we went into Iraq talking about Smedley Butler. And the war is a racket. The rich get richer and the poor get dead frames. And here we are. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Again, I go back to this, you know, just being ripped apart. And again, look, I look at the Republican Party, and it's amazing to me that in this moment, you've got Republicans defending the Saudis and the picture of Trump with his hand on the orb with the Saudis and the coziness there, the money Elon Musk probably got for Twitter. I mean, it's there's a lot. There is a lot here. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Steve on line one from Chicago. Steve, how are you?
Fine, thank you. And I think that, you know, that this is, as you pointed out, you know, one of those seminal events in a generation's history. You know, the there are various times that define each generation. For some, it was Pearl Harbor. Others, you know, they will ask themselves, where were you when you heard that Kennedy was shot? And then, you know, moving forward, you know, the generation that for whom 9/11 happened, whether you were in elementary school, high school, college, or in the working world. I was in downtown Chicago, living in one of those high rises, 21st floor, floor to ceiling windows, and behind my television set was the Sears Tower. You know, you could see it in the background because I was living downtown. And you know, the whole, so I'm watching the coverage, and like everyone else, I thought, okay, well, a plane hit the first building. I mean, that could be anything. I mean, how long was it before a plane was going to end up hitting a high rise somewhere? But, you know, as soon as that second plane came in, you said, holy, you're like, look how big that thing is. Oh, and as soon as it hit, you right then and there, never, like everyone else did. Okay, this is not an accident. And then we just started, we all started to look up, you know, my friends who were in the neighborhood, we'd call each other. Okay, I mean, you know, John Hancock Building, Sears Tower. And then we came to find many months and years later that they actually had planned to target the Sears Tower. But that never came to fruition. But as you pointed out, you know, we then sold the American public, because like every war, people get scared and then they get angry and they want to lash out, and you can sell them on anything. And then the American people just didn't want to make the distinction. You know, I am no fan of the Taliban, but the Taliban were not Al-Qaeda, and they had no designs outside of Afghanistan. They had allowed Al-Qaeda refuge in Afghanistan. And for those people who don't know it, they were willing to give them up to us to keep us out of their country. But that wasn't good enough for us, apparently. And so obviously we need to prosecute that war. And you can have a debate as to whether or not we belong there post 9/11. That there is a debate to be had there. There is no debate to be had with regard to trying to create the dubious relationship between 9/11 and the need to invade Iraq. It was just ridiculous, but that's how that war was sold, and we all know it. And unfortunately, you know, the Fourth Estate and a lot of other people who were supposed to be the watchdogs in this democracy, this constitutional republic, were asleep at the wheel or just afraid to say anything. There were a few people who did, but, you know, by and large, they were drowned out. And, you know, and we're going to be paying that price for those wars for decades to come, because the people who died there, we're going to be supporting their families. The people who were hurt physically, we're going to be supporting them. And that mental trauma doesn't go away. You know, this was the longest war that we had ever fought in this country's history. And that means you had a whole generation. You could have fought in that war, had a child, that child could have gone off and fought in the same war. And in some cases that happened. That's how long we're going to be paying for this many, many years down the road. And so we need to consider that every time we think about prosecuting a war somewhere, not just what it's going to cost today, but what it's going to cost 30, 40, 50 years from now. Because 20-year-olds become 70 and 80-year-olds. And when they need the VA and they need other services, you know, you have to pay for that. So is it worth it, and who's willing to pay that bill? And that's not even, you know, taking into consideration the lives that were taken overseas prosecuting the war. And I'm not one of these people who believes that, you know, the United States should not defend itself. Absolutely, there are enemies out there, and there are times when it's necessary to use the military to defend this country's interests and to defend our national security. But at the same time, there are times when, in the name of doing that, we have committed wholesale slaughter. And what we did to Iraq as a country, I mean, it's almost unforgivable. And let's face it, we knew full well what was going to happen. And the idea that you're going to bomb somebody into the Stone Age, and then you're going to publicly announce, oh, by the way, we're now engaged in the process of nation building. I mean, that is a multi-generational commitment of trillions upon trillions of dollars. And I mean, so what is the plan here? We're going to go from country to country doing this? Because that essentially would have been the formula if we had decided to go down this route indefinitely. So, you know, I don't know, you know, what it means for us. We don't seem to learn our lessons like a lot of, you know, great powers in the world. We had to learn it in Vietnam, and then we sort of were modest for a while. And then, you know, the first Gulf War sort of reinvigorated Americans and said, oh, okay, yeah, we won the Cold War, and we're now the greatest power in the world. And I firmly believe that 9/11 was even more devastating, because those of us who are old enough to remember, you know, the 1990s I consider to be possibly the last great decade in American history. You know, yeah, crime went down significantly. Wages went up. Unemployment went down. I mean, it was a really great decade. I mean, the introduction of what we enjoy today in terms of modern technology, the Internet and personal computers and all this sort of thing. And then came 9/11. And it all came crashing down. The party came to an end. So it wasn't just that it was just an average decade. It was a really good decade. And then 9/11 happens, and everything changes. We go to war, and then of course you had the economic crash of 2008, 2009, the worst in a generation since really the Great Depression. And then of course that takes us into the presidency of Barack Obama. I think hanging in the right direction, but of course that invariably leads us to the presidency of Donald Trump.
because that's part of the backlash of the election of Barack Obama, who, of course, won in no small part because people were disillusioned with the leadership of the Republican Party in terms of the wars and the economy and so forth. So all of these things are connected. We get to exactly where we are today by going back to that day.
Yeah, no, you're spot on. You did a much better opening than I would have done. I appreciate the thought, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Spot on. I mean, it's exactly the thoughts right there. Let's go to real quick. Let's get Alice on line two. Alice, how are you doing today?
I'm insane as usual. I remember 911 very well, and I had worked the night before a night shift. And my mother called me at like 10 till 9 in the morning, and my mother was starting to go into dementia. And she was like, she's telling me, she had woke me up, and she was telling me, and I thought she was just like hallucinating again. And then my son got on the phone, and he was like, no, Mom, it happened. So I turned the TV on, and I remember that entire day. I worked day shift, and we had the television on. And I remember later that evening, the roads were just completely dead. And one of my customers, his son, was working in the towers.
Oh, my God.
And it wasn't until like 2 days later that he found out that his son was alive. And it
was
just, I remember how everyone just pulled together. So, and the thing is, what a lot of people conveniently forget, I think it was 15 or 16 of the terrorists were Saudi Arabians.
Yep.
It wasn't Afghanis.
Yep.
It was Saudi Arabia. But there you are.
There you go.
So
thanks,
you have
Alice.
A good evening, Rick. Oh, and check your email.
Will do. That's the other part. And again, I go back to Trump with the orbs and Kushner with the $2 billion. You kind of got to wonder. Let's go to Julie in Minnesota on line three. Julie, how are you?
Hi, I just heard you the last several minutes. She is so right. We have to tell the younger generation that's been born since 9/11 that we went after the wrong people. You know, we got the Saudi Arabian family out of the United States on the evening that 9/11 happened, and we went after the wrong people, and we have to let the newer generation know about that. You know, I had a relative that was in the CIA for about 35 years, and he retired about the time, shortly after 9/11, but he still worked for the CIA independently. He was not an agent. He was a little further up the line. He's passed now, so I feel like I can talk about this. I asked him, do you think we should go into Iraq? And right away he said, no, I'm more concerned about North Korea. And I was kind of surprised because I'll tell you something, Rick, this was the most conservative man you can imagine, born in a small town in the upper Midwest. He and his family always voted Republican, but he didn't hesitate a minute. He thought going in, he didn't actually, you know, criticize the president, but he said, no, we shouldn't be going in there. And so I thought that was kind of interesting. I'll just say one more thing. My car was stolen the night of 9/11 because there were such rumors about gas prices spiking. And I think that I went over to my mother's apartment building, and I think that's the reason my car was stolen. Some people in Minneapolis just panicked. They just freaked out.
Was it just Minneapolis?
Gas prices.
Yeah. No, I appreciate the call, Julie. I appreciate it. Thanks so much. Having your car stolen on that night, again, something else to remember. But, you know, it's an interesting thing she brings up there, you know, because I've known people over the years, you know, who are in the intelligence world who are like, you know, no reason to go into Iraq. You had Iraq. You had our installed tin pot dictator keeping rule of that region. You know, and again, it comes back to our not understanding. And look, I didn't either understand that Iraq is really like three different countries with three different complete cultures and all this stuff where it would be chaos if you took that strong man out of there. This idea that we're going to impose democracy on an area that's never had it is kind of, well, arrogant. But it was never about that. As it was explained to me, it was about the money. Which is why we, every September 11th, the call is open up the records. Let us all see what was presented to Congress. Rumsfeld's dead. Most of the people who Bush sent in to do this stuff are gone. Open up what was shown to our elected leaders. And I've been told, and in a little bit, I'm sure we're going to have one of those people tell me the same thing again, that if I was shown what he was shown, I would have gone along with it. He can't tell me what he was shown because it's sealed. So for the younger generation, the call is open up those records so that we get to see what happened and make sure it never happens again, which is why I'm a big supporter of transparency in government so that we're not fooled again. Now, on going into Iraq, I was never fooled. Never bought the aluminum tubes, never bought the cartoon drawings of mobile labs. Look, I knew Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And everyone did, because we gave them to him. He was our tin pot dictator. We put him there. But you could argue, had a lot to do with money and a lot to do with oil. If you remember, Operation Iraqi Liberation. Oil. That was the original operational name for it before they turned it into Operation Iraqi Freedom. Oops on that one. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2001. We pause to remember those who died in the 9/11 attacks. Of those killed, nearly a quarter were union people. Hundreds of firefighters were lost, dozens of building tradespeople, and many other unions lost members as well, including the AFT, SEIU, Unite Here, CWA, and AFSCME. Those lost that day will remain firmly forever in our memories. What is less well known is the number of those first responders who are suffering from chronic and fatal diseases related to 9/11 or those who have already died. It is estimated that over 400,000 people were exposed to World Trade Center contaminants. These include more than 70 carcinogens and other hazardous substances. Of those exposed, over 91,000 were first responders. As of June 2017, over 67,000 first responders and over 12,000 survivors had registered in the World Trade Center Health Program, run by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The program provides medical monitoring, health evaluations, and treatment for those who qualify. Of those registered responders still alive, more than 45,000 suffer from certified conditions, as defined by the Zadroga Act of 2010. And for registered survivors, nearly 10,000 suffer from certified conditions. Close to 700 registered first responders have already died from certified conditions. However, this number is considered a low estimate given that there were many who died before the program was established. There are also a number of illnesses believed related to the attacks but not yet certified. If you are a survivor or were a 9/11 first responder and would like to enroll in the World Trade Center Health Program, please visit cdc.gov/WTC or call toll-free 1-888-982-4748.
Last week, I talked about how Labor Day was created in the 1880s by rebellious workers. But I'm celebrating the spirit again this week because a momentous new energy has been building in today's union movement. Indeed, renewed union rebelliousness has put labor back in Labor Day. Previously cast as a day off, it's now a day on, rallying working class activism and celebrating nationwide strikes by such disparate groups as Teamsters and Hollywood actors. This is making the corporate bosses very antsy, for it's the harbinger of a new order that is undermining absolutist boss rule. Particularly alarming to the plutocratic establishment is the new aggressiveness of the United Auto Workers Union under their recently elected grassroots president, Sean Fain. Tossing aside the old willingness to accept incremental changes in contract negotiations, Fain began the current bargaining round by literally throwing the industry's proposal in the wastebasket, bluntly declaring that's where it belongs. Such honesty has spooked Detroit's auto barons, who are wailing that the workers' demands are, quote, excessive. This from Pampered CEOs, each pocketing between $20 and $34 million a year in personal pay. Pathetically, the corporate establishment has no better retort to feign than to try its tired old Red Scare bugaboo. "This man studied Trotsky," squealed one squeamish corporatist on TV. No. Instead, Sean Fain has clearly studied Walter Reuther, Mother Jones, Fighting Bob La Follette, Frederick Douglass, Cesar Chavez, and other American champions of economic fairness and social justice. This is Jim Hightower saying, the big story here is not that a president of one workers' organization is shaking things up, but that organized workers themselves are on the move, demanding economic democracy.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So evidently, a group of seven activists were arrested for unlawful entry into Speaker McCarthy's office on Monday. And I, you know, of course, you know the right wing losing their mind. This is just like January 6th. They should be conspiracy and... You know this is where they're going with this, because this is what they do. They take these couple of people who did this, and now they're going to extrapolate it into some huge conspiracy, because again, it's about both sidesism. And again, you know, you look at how they use the system to attack average, everyday working people. And I got that, it's shameless. Anyway, we're here to share some thoughts on his most recent article. On just something like this. You remember last week we talked with Greg Palast about, you know, all the stuff going on with Trump in Georgia, and then the stuff you don't hear about a couple of protesters who protest Cop City getting almost the same, if not worse, charges under the RICO Act by the state of Georgia. Well, our next guest has written a new piece over at the Philadelphia Inquirer. That's why I've asked Will Bunch to come talk with him. He's a national columnist there at the Inquirer. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Hey, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
I got to get your thoughts first on, obviously, today being the anniversary of 9/11. You know, where were you? What were you doing? Thoughts?
Yeah, well, I was the writer for the Philadelphia Daily News who, whenever something huge in the world happened, I was the guy who had to write that story. So the minute the second plane hit the World Trade Center, which I almost never watched the Today Show, and I happened to be watching that morning, and that's where I was watching when those two planes crashed. I mean, the minute the second one goes, well, I guess I usually went into the office later, and I was like, well, I guess I'm going in. And we had a puppy who, it's been 22 years, so now she's long gone, but a puppy at the time who we were training, so I couldn't go to the office without taking her out in the backyard for 10 minutes. And I remember that because I remember what a beautiful, do you remember, Rick, what a beautiful day that was? It was the bluest sky I've ever seen in my life. It was about 85 degrees, kind of warm, but not too hot. And it was a beautiful day. And I'm out here with this puppy thinking about in my backyard and thinking about the beauty of that and the horror I had just witnessed on TV and how I was going to have to get in my car and go write about it. And I mean, it's just a day none of us will ever forget. And you know, I wrote a column. They asked me to write a column 2 years ago for the 20th anniversary, and I wrote about that, what I just told you, and I wrote about how when I had to write a story, you know, we didn't know. I mean, maybe there were a few whispered suspicions that it was Osama bin Laden. But if you remember, we didn't know who did this on September 11th, 2001. And we didn't know how many people were dead. People were saying it could be 10,000. There was so much we didn't know. And I remember writing this story saying September 11th, 2001 will be remembered, you know, is the day that things would never be the same again for America. And, you know, 20 years later, I look back, it's like, wow, I said that? Because, and the thing is, what's weird is I was right, right? I mean, because I'm not always right, but I was right that time in the sense. And but like I said in the column, we didn't know how things wouldn't be the same. Like, you know, it's weird because 9/11, I think, you know, for a very brief time, brought out so much of the best of us and the way that people responded, both, I mean, certainly the really heroic people, the first responders, but even just the way everyday people all across the country responded, and everybody was outraged and unified with their neighbors. And, you know, it was the only time in the last 30 years that all the red, blue, Democrat, Republican stuff didn't matter that much for a few weeks. And then we ruined it, basically, you know, we ruined it by using it as an excuse to go after Iraq, as an excuse to stay in Afghanistan for 20 years, and then we started turning against other people, people warned them when they created this Homeland Security apparatus. And sure enough, you know, we created this, you know, kind of build the wall regime against immigration. That was next. And this ties directly into what we're going to talk about with Cop City in Atlanta. But, you know, then the next thing was using Homeland Security and these other powers against dissent, protest. Yeah. Remember in 2020 when the Trump administration was sending these, like, you know, secret police type Homeland Security officers out to Portland, Oregon, to take on, you know, the people they call Antifa, you know, and snatching people and putting them in vans. Remember that?
That doesn't get reported on in the right wing media. Never hear about that.
Yeah, but you and I talk about it, so that's good. That's something. So, I think the headline on my column was, you know, 9/11 was the day we knew 9/11 was going to change America forever. We didn't know how bad it would be. I think the animosities that were and the hatred that was unleashed fueled right into our current crisis.
I was in Cleveland at the time, and I remember, you know, you were saying that it unified us. I saw it as it unified some of us, but it did pit people against each other, especially, you know, foreigners. You know, and Cleveland is a very, you know, segregated city. At least when I lived there, it was. So, you know, immediately there was an attack on a church there. As I remember, some guy drove up the church steps. There was a whole bunch of anger outleashed on certain communities. And that's what really began the whole, you know, tearing us apart. And also I remember, you know, again, after 9/11, they rammed through the Patriot Act.
I went to a
League of Women Voters debate on the Patriot Act. They had a panel of three people who were for, three people who were against. The people who were against actually read the bill, actually read everything. The people who were for it, well, they got the cliff notes. But yeah. I remember people just saying, look, I want to be safe. I don't care. Give me a national ID card. Let me give you my thumbprint. I just want to be safe. And they played on that.
Yeah, I mean, it was crazy the things that happened. I mean, I remember my kids were in elementary school at the time, and, you know, their elementary school built this weird security setup, you know, because they thought the terrorists were going to come to this, you know, elementary school in the Philadelphia suburbs, and all the, like, field trips that were canceled, and just weird stuff that we forget about now. And but, you know, you mentioned the Patriot Act, and to me, that was like the first, that's when my mindset started to change. And, you know, I mean, I tell people all the time that that 2 year stretch from between 9/11 and the start of and the beginning of the Iraq War, I guess it was less than 2 years actually, that period truly radicalized me. You know, I honestly was a center left guy. I wouldn't say I was quite a both sides journalist, but you know, my perspective on things was much different. And to use the overused term of the decade, I mean, I kind of got woke right after the Patriot Act, and really, you know, really then when things turned to Iraq, and particularly with the fact that the media, which I thought, you know, this is the media that we created after Watergate to protect the country from idiocy, you know, and instead the opposite happened. Instead, you know, the vast majority of the media advanced this obvious, you know, I mean, you could tell in real time it was a lie. And the fact that the media wasn't calling them out on this, I did the best I could from my little perch in the Philadelphia Daily News, but you know, that didn't do too much good. But it radicalized me. It really did.
Well, again, you look at where we are in this moment, where again the media spends a lot of time, you know, on the horse race and on you know, the yeah. all the Trump stuff that's going on, and yet very few people, if any. And you know, last week I talked with Greg Palast about what's going on with these protesters down at this Cop City thing being charged under the RICO Act and could face years in prison for simply protesting. Is it's insane, but you know, there's no coverage on this that I can really find.
I've seen some because I search for it, but you're right. If the average person isn't seeing the news about what's going on in Cop City, and you know,
so
it's,
before we start, what is Cop City, so folks know?
Oh sure. Well, it's the nickname that's been given to what the government calls the Atlanta Police Training Center. So Atlanta wants to spend $90 million, some of it's taxpayer money, some of it is donated by this foundation that's funded by every gigantic corporation in Atlanta that you could think of: Home Depot, Waffle House, Delta, the corporation that owns the one newspaper in town, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which you'll be shocked to learn constantly editorializes and beats the drum for this police training center, Cop City. So they want to build this thing. It's going to have a mock city to teach these cops how to put down unrest, like the people who marched after George Floyd's murder, you know. And it's fascinating, you know, just last year, I think in 2022, there was this documentary that not too many people saw, but it was really fantastic, called Riotsville, USA. And what it chronicled was in the 1960s, after all the unrest, like after Martin Luther King was assassinated, they built not one but two of these mock cities to teach cops how, you know, instead of trying to fix these cities, they built mock cities to show cops how to crush protests. And so it's not a new idea, but you know, it's interesting. I mean, tying it all together with like 9/11. I mean, since 9/11, some of the things, you know, first we saw the militarization of local police, you know, these army surplus personnel carriers. Yep.
My little podunk town's got a tank.
Yeah, a tank, right? It's insane, right? You know, giving these towns the tanks, and certainly the, you know, the riot cops who, you know, I heard some conversation the other day, people were talking about the famous 1968 Democratic convention in Chicago and the protests there, and they pointed out that it was terrible, but you see the cops out there in just their blue shirts and they have a nightstick, which is not great, but and you look at the cops they sent out today with the masks and the stun guns and all the equipment, and it's just insane. So that's kind of where it started. Some of the tactics, like kettling protesters and arresting hundreds of them, I mean, that's been going on since 1999, the 2000s, and
well, with the battle in Seattle, I mean,
yeah, that's why I said 1999. That's kind of where it all started, I think. But then in the last few years, and really accelerated after 2020 and the George Floyd protests, you've seen states passing a lot of stuff with oil companies and climate change, right? Where now it's a crime, you know, now it's like a major felony to do anything in or around a pipeline, or even the trespass on an oil pipeline is like a felony in some states now, especially red states. But these laws where, you know, you basically have the right to plow your car into a group of protesters and get away with it. Florida, of course, under DeSantis, passed an extreme anti-protest law a couple of years ago. And so what's happening in Cop City, there've been a lot of protests. One thing about this police training center is it's being built in a very environmentally sensitive area that, you know, it's 85 acres of, you know, lush forest on the edge of Atlanta, are being raised to build this project. And so it's attracted a lot of environmental activists, you know, call them eco warriors or whatever, but people who were willing to camp out in the woods and occupy this site and try, you know. And so in January of this year, 2023, there was a confrontation and a police officer shot and killed one of these eco protesters at the Cop City site, you know, and claimed that he was shot at and it was self-defense. And there's, you know, more holes in the police story than in a hunk of Swiss cheese, right? And then around the time, the state of Georgia, you know, and there's the Democratic prosecutors in the two relevant counties haven't covered themselves with glory, but really it is the Republicans, Brian Kemp and this Republican attorney general who wants to succeed Brian Kemp, this guy named Chris Carr, who earlier this year, they lodged domestic terrorism charges against a few dozen of the protesters. Then they raided the office of the bail fund that all it does is raise money to, you know, when these protesters get locked up, they'll bail them out. Yeah. And they accused them of
aiding and abetting
money laundering.
Oh, wow.
Money laundering. Yeah. I mean, just insane. And so, you know, I've been fascinated by this story. And in June, I convinced my editors in Philadelphia to send me down there for 4 days and report as much as I could, you know. I mean, I kind of helicoptered in, I guess, but to report as much as I could. And I really tried to meet as many people from the community and activists and talk to people about what's really going on there.
Yeah. We had talked with Greg Palace last week about this, and, you know, and he said, look, you know, the local district attorneys, you know, didn't charge people with this stuff. They charged them for the crimes that they committed, trespassing. If they broke a window, they got charged with breaking a window.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the whole thing about civil disobedience is, you know, I mean, you plan to get arrested. You are blocking a street or you're trespassing or whatever. And, you know, not nonviolent civil disobedience, you know. And look, I you know, I don't know if you and Greg talked about this, but I mean, there have been some acts of violence in terms of net property violence, not against people, but there's been acts of.
That's what I said. If someone broke a window, you charge them for what they did.
Yeah, you vandalize a bulldozer or something. Okay, that's fine. But no, what they decided to do, this was rumored when I was down there in June, and now they've done it, which is RICO charges. You know, if you've been following the Trump stuff, you know all about Georgia's RICO law now, and they have a pretty aggressive racketeering statute down there. Well, it's being used against people in an environmental and social justice protest movement are being charged as racketeers for taking part in this movement. And, you know, and some of the quote overt acts, as they call it, that are part of this racketeering enterprise are just ridiculous. You know, one of them was a guy signing ACAB, which, you know, stands for All Cops Are Bastards, you know, on a letter. That was an overt act. Somebody committed an overt act buying glue because apparently, I guess, they thought it protesters were going to glue themselves to something at the site, you know.
But here's the thing.
And this bail fund, raising bail, but, you know, mutual aid, collectivism, they define anarchism, you know, and I'm not an anarchist personally, but I think it's a philosophy people can legitimately have and discuss, but not in Georgia, where anarchism has been defined as a crime, basically, now under this indictment. It's really radical stuff.
So last question I've got for you on this, because, you know, I know some of my MAGA hat wearing friends are out there going, well, we should be able to build our cop city because we got to protect ourselves. We need cops to keep us safe. And look, I support the police when they're not wrong. What do you say to people who go, you know, we need to enforce the law. We need to have, you know, people who are going to do this. And, you know, why does this matter to the red hats that were prosecuting people under the RICO Act for protesting?
Yeah, well, you know, the big thing, and in the long story I wrote back in June about Cop City, I got into this a lot, which is that Well, first of all, I mean, there are much less expensive and more reasonable options. I mean, this $90 million thing is kind of a Taj Mahal type thing. And it's a matter of civic priorities. You know, Atlanta is maybe the most gentrified city in America. They've seen their Black population in just a short time go from 62% to 47% because working class Black people are being driven out of Atlanta. You know, and this isn't just any city. This is Martin Luther King's city. This is the cradle of the civil rights movement. And, you know, Black people are being driven out, and it's a matter of resources. The resources that could be used to help neighborhoods, help people stay in their homes, you know, and give people opportunities where they live with social programs is instead being spent on police and this Taj Mahal. So yeah, people want to stop it. I mean, you know, I want a certain kind of better police training. I want them trained to be part of their community. I want them to be trained to not
de-escalate.
To not be an occupying army, but to you know, see themselves as you know, people who are there to serve the community and not to lock up the community. But there's no evidence that Cop City would be that type of facility. You know, that it would further the kind of warrior cop policing that's been so detrimental
that we've seen on TV so much. The article, "Georgia Criminalizes Post George Floyd Protests and a New Blow to Democracy," written by Will Bunch. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. Will, as always, fabulous stuff. I appreciate you taking some time, keeping us informed and up to date.
Oh, Rick, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Good stuff. Thanks so much, our good friend Will Bunch. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1851. That was the day that a Maryland planter named Edward Gorsuch was killed in Christiana, Pennsylvania. Gorsuch had come to Pennsylvania to try and recapture three Black men that had escaped from slavery on his farm outside of Baltimore 2 years earlier. A year after the men escaped, Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Act. This penalized helping those who had escaped slavery with a $1,000 fine and up to 6 months in jail. Emboldened by the law, slave catchers chased those who had made the journey to freedom in the North. Gorsuch received news that the men he was looking for were in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. Two of the escaped slaves were at the farm of William Parker, a Black man who had also escaped slavery in Maryland. Located just north of the Mason-Dixon line, Lancaster had a well-established Underground Railroad network. An armed Black self-defense group had developed to stand against the slave catchers. Gorsuch and his son gathered a group of men and headed north. At the Parker farm, they were confronted by a group of at least 50 Black men armed with guns and pitchforks. Gorsuch refused to leave, and a gun battle erupted. Gorsuch was shot and killed in the exchange of fire. Parker, his family, and the three formerly enslaved men fled to Canada. 38 others who were there that day were charged with treason for taking part in the confrontation. This included Castor Hanway, a white man who had tried to defuse the standoff. None of the charged were ever convicted. In the South, slave owners were outraged that no one was punished. Tensions between the North and South sharpened. As a result, the country moved closer to the Civil War, the bloody conflict that finally ended slave labor. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter @laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So evidently, lawyers for Donald Trump have asked the judge, Tanya Chutkan, to recuse herself because evidently, I don't know what cockamamie reason they came up with. She was a former assistant public defender. She was appointed by Obama. I don't know. Whichever one it was, that's what we're getting. Maybe it was because she was one of the tougher, sentencers on the January 6th people. Who knows? Now, here's the thing. This is where I'm talking to my lefty friends here. When she doesn't recuse herself, and she shouldn't, and should just throw this out, if that hasn't happened already, please don't call her a hero. Please don't put her on a pedestal. Don't call her brave. Don't do any of those things. This is a judge doing their job. Let's not elevate this stuff to make them social media stars or.
You're listening to WLAK 1260 AM Amory and WBZH 910 AM W245 CT Hayward. Always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media app.
News.